Every Woman is a womanish show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 50% of the world's population and 52% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group. And every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The opinions and views expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the KKFI board, staff, volunteers, or sponsors of KKFI and the Midcoast Radio Project, Incorporated.
Good afternoon. This is Sharon Lockhart back again with Amy Bell. And today I'm very excited. I've been waiting for this since January 22nd, since our plane landed from Bangalore, India. I have John Fish Kerman and Rakmi Shiza as guests today, and they're going to talk about our trip to India that I invited myself to go with them to meet or to introduce Rakmi's new husband to her family. And he said last April 1st, when I said, oh, can I go? He said, I'll ask Rakmi. And lo and behold, she said it would be okay, and I had a marvelous time. I want to tell everyone, Rakmi Shiza has a marvelous family of people that I would truly like to go back again and see. And maybe we will, because we're working on a little project. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Sharon.
And Rakmi.
Thank you, Sharon.
I will confess, Sharon, that neither one of us, when you first asked, can I go, neither one of us really thought you were serious, especially once you found out how expensive it is. But we enjoyed having you along with us.
Well, good.
And yes, I would like to also say that, you know, it was very, like, meaningful that both you and John came with me, and I was just very touched and happy, like, how you both dive into the culture and to all the things that they were doing, instead of, like, you know, asking for, oh, we don't want to eat this, or we don't want to drink this. So that was really, really touching, and my family was very happy. All of them were very happy that, wow, you know, here is a, they think that both of you will be somehow difficult to give their hospitality, but my family and even my community embrace both of you, like, as if they are, both of you are their own family or people, your people.
And I truly felt that, didn't you, John?
Absolutely. They were so welcoming and so so open to us. And, you know, I didn't know what they thought of Americans, whether they knew much about Americans. Apparently they thought Americans were maybe a little demanding. I don't know. or that we would want more Western accommodations
and all of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. But,
I'm going to let you guys start out here because
okay.
You know what you want to share. I have impressions, lots of things that I saw that made me really respect how hard the people, particularly in the Northeast India, the village, the town that Rakmi grew up in, how difficult life is, the things they must do, that it's almost like they're 100 years ago where we were, with the water and
washing clothes
and
cooking.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Perhaps we should take a step back and talk about why we went to India, which has to do with where you're from. Dear, you want to talk about where you're from?
Sure. I'm just very excited that, you know, like, I am here. I would have never thought when I was back home growing up in a small town called Ukhrul, which was named as a Hunpun, that's the original name, but I think that the Ukhrul was given, was named by the British when they were still ruling India. So I would have never thought that one day I will sit in KKFI station and talk about my small hometown, but I am excited to talk about it. Ukhrul is one of my favorite places. Still today, because of not only because of, that I was born there and grew up there and my whole family is there, but because of the geographical setting and all those things that is around, there is something beautiful about that place. The Danku Naga lives there, and so the Danku people is a tribe from northeast India. It's a very mountainous place, like you have both seen, and I just saw that there are, I think it's according to 2011 census, that there are 75,000 people in Ukrul Dong where we visit. So while growing up, it was a very like a simple place. I grew up in a two worlds. One, a very simple lifestyle where, you know, I play marbles and we have a game called Sautera, which I don't know what it's called in English, but it's a round dry beans that we find it in a forest. And it was such a fun game and only girls can play that. So those kind of free, like we play that on the weekends until like the sunset. And, you know, we go like on the weekends when we are not in the school, we go to the river to fish or go gather wildflowers and wild fruits and or even go gather firewood. So that was just so much fun to have. I mean, at that time, it was tiring to go gather firewood for family. But looking back, I think that was one of the funnest things that I too, because I was so carefree, and we had a lot of social time, community time together. Whenever we do that, we never do it alone. Like there would be 10 to 15 of us, all girls, and some boys comes with us, but mostly it's all girls. But the other part of the world that I grew up was a very, you know, scary situation because in our Naga history, Naga has been fighting for their own free homeland. From 1918 and to struggle against those freedoms, against to gather freedom, there was a lot of military crisis, social problems, political chaos, and a lot of uncertainty. And not only that, but starting late 80s, no, it was early 80s, AIDS came into our land, and until today, AIDS is Manipur stands the second highest state in India, in the whole India, that the rate of AIDS that's growing. And not only the AIDS, but there was like tribalism, tribal conflict, and so all of those. That I grew up in the midst of that, but so I grew up in this one beautiful world that is surrounded by mountains, flowers, rivers, and forests. And the other part is that there is that uncertainty. But as I, you know, like I used to think that life was very, very hard, and I used to really, really want to get away from that place. In my late teen and early 20s, I was so eager to get away that place, and I think that's another reason why I am here. Not only because of that I came to America. I came to America to because I believe in education, and I was not able to get the education that I want to get while I was in Ukrul because of the financial situation. But now that I am in Kansas City, Missouri, living here, when I look back, yes, life was hard in Ukrul, but there were so many things that keeps us meaning. And I think that for many, many years, our people, in spite of all the social problems, military crisis there, for many years we were healthy. We stayed together, a close community, and we inspire each other, and there was a strong sense of community. And I think it is because of the If I am living here in Kansas City where I don't see mountains or river, that something inside me is, I find it sometimes missing, and that comparing to the hardships that I face in India and in Ukraine, even though we have all those physical hardship, there was always an encouragement and inspiring moments while I was growing up. And I was a dreamer. I was very ambitious. I think of all these ideas, and I do think that because we grow up in a close connection with the nature, the forest, the river, we were never away from them. We were a part of them. And so I think there is something that gives me that life. So that's a brief description of Ukraine, and maybe John can tell.
Do you want to talk some about the impact of the mainland India culture and how much Western culture impacted you as you were growing up?
Yeah, sure. While I was growing up, you know, like there was no TV around. I mean, the TV that I see was after early 90. So I didn't, you know, there was, we can hear music. I mean, like the music was always there. But then education is the main thing. After we were Christianized in the late 1889 by American Baptist missionary named William Pettigrew. After we were Christianized, we were taught that all our cultures, our folk songs, our folk tales, are like a kind of a pagan. And so in our generation, we completely leave behind that. And in the school, you know, we were taught Western education, and sometimes we were taught to be ashamed of our own cultures, of our own song. And I remember that my mother and my father always want to sing our traditional song, which is called Haula. And it's, I don't even know their meaning anymore. And it's so beautiful. But then... The Christianity banned that song, and so because it is sinful and it is not Christian song. And so after I came here and I tried to research all the songs that, you know, my father wrote a customary book, and when he wrote out that, I look at some of the songs, and the song is all about our history. And it's our history, and we are forgetting that. And so there is this true education. There is good things about this education. Because of education, I'm here. But because of the Western education that is influencing our in our land, that we are forgetting the rich culture that we have. And so presently, you both have seen how we were, that, you know, I'll talk for myself that I know more about the Western band, musical band, than I do about my own cultural song. I know the Judas Priest, I know Dire Straits, I know Guns N' Roses, and I was a heavy metal fan. I know all of those things, but if you tell me to sing one of my ancestor song, I don't know. I don't even know the meaning of it. And so that was the influence of the Western education. And not only that, now we are within these 10 years, people have started to wanting to live more Western life, that even the food we are eating is changing. While growing up, you know, my mother has this two big hilly farm, and it's all like organic product that we eat that we grow what for our food. We don't depend on the outside, except, you know, like sugar and salt, which we don't have it, which we don't manufacture there. But, you know, like all these vegetables, we grow for ourselves. But then after I left, I'm here now already 14 years. Within these 10 years, when I go back, things have changed a lot. People are starting to give up farming, and they are relying more on the outside processed food that is coming in. And then the consequences of that, the diseases that I never heard when I was growing up, it's happening. Yes, AIDS was there, but AIDS comes through by drugs, using heroin.
Dirty needles.
Yes.
Yeah.
True
mm-hmm.
injection, but like diabetic, mm-hmm. kidney problem, obesity, heart problem, it was very real. Very real, yeah. I heard only one person when I was like growing up, that one lady that was a diabetic patient, but nowadays there is like everybody seems to be, nobody has any statistics on this because no one has done a research on this. So John and I are talking, you know, like, I know Sharon, I also shared it with you too, that we need to do something. We need to have, I mean, we need to research something about this. And so all of those new things are showing up.
And cancer.
And cancer, yes. I just got an email from one of my friends saying that two of his relatives just passed away with cancer, just in this within this 2013 and 2014. And so that was just very, very new.
We talked about a little bit about how we in the Western culture have had time to acclimate to the poor diets we are now eating. So that perhaps the sudden impact that's being noticed in India is due to the fact that it's happened in the last 10 years, that packaged food and McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken, and they're everywhere. I mean, they're all over Bangalore. I don't remember seeing one in Ukhrul, but...
Yeah. No, we don't have that one.
Yeah.
But we have the potato chips,
yeah.
And all those like cheeses stuff, which is not even our diet. You know, we don't have cheese in our land, so, but they are eating that right now.
Yeah, there's a big influx now of wheat, things made out of wheat, which would not have been part of the traditional Tangkul or Naga diet. Lots and lots of sugar is now available.
Yeah.
I mean, some sugar was available, I'm sure, when you were young, but not nearly in the quantities that it is now. And it's just amazing, the food products.
And I wanted to ask you to talk about the diet in your homeland, Rakmi. What did you eat growing up?
Very simple food. You know, as I say that we grow our own food, I mean, there are people like who has money, they can afford to buy, you know, like we think that's an expensive, high standard food, like butter, like dry milk, and anything that sells in the store. But majority of us, I should say, you know, like among the 100, only 10 can afford to buy those things. But 90% of us, like, depend on what the nature give us. And so while growing up, my mom always farmed. My mom she's 74, and she just gave up farming 7 years ago. She has this hilly farm, and she plant potato, pumpkins, squash, peppers.
Don't forget the rice.
Yes.
is the staple.
Yes, the rice. And rice is also not like heavily processed, refined like the one that we get in America. Rice, my
mom... It wasn't when you were growing up, but now
no,
they're eating
yes,
white rice.
Yes. When I was growing up, we have this purple rice that we grow in our own rice field. And so... It's very simple, just that rice, and we don't use a lot of oil. Everything that we cook with water and put like either ginger or garlic and hot pepper.
I was going to say, don't forget the hot pepper.
I know. Yeah, and a lot of green leaves. That, you know, it's a very simple diet, but As you both see now, you know, like we use more cooking oil and we use more like the processed things that like is available in the market. So, yeah.
I wanted to talk some about the history of the Tangkhul and the larger Naga ethnic group, because it's really important to put where we are now, where the Tangkhul and where the Naga are now in perspective. If we go back 200 years from today, all of the, well, the people, the ethnic group that's now known as the Naga, didn't think of themselves as the Naga. They weren't a single group. There were somewhere in the range of 15 to 20 tribes. There's currently 17 recognized Naga tribes. But even within tribes, each individual village was its own society. And they certainly had contact with nearby villages and traded with nearby villages and maybe intermarried and that sort of thing. But they also sometimes would fight with each other, as neighbors will do. But they had no real concept of themselves as all being one ethnic group. Each village thought of themselves as their own group. And then the British, of course, came in, and after conquering and colonizing India, they started to take over what is now Northeast India. And for folks who aren't familiar with a map of India, this is over by Burma and Bhutan. I posted a link to a map of India on the Every Woman Facebook page for those who have access to a computer while we're on air here. This part of India is sort of like an island. It's attached to the mainland part of India just by a thin strip of land north of what is now Bangladesh. The people there kind of think of themselves as an island away from India, as not really being part of the larger India. So the British took control of the Kingdom of Assam in 1828, and they didn't yet go into the areas where the Naga people lived, but they signed a non-aggression pact with the Naga people, because traditionally the Naga tribes would raid the Kingdom of Assam, from what I understand, and I do need to say that I'm no expert on the history here. I've done some research, but I can't go into great detail. But the British signed a non-aggression pact, and over time there were raids back and forth, and the British would make military expeditions into the Naga Mountains. They established a military post there in 1851. And very quickly, British missionaries started going into the Naga villages to Christianize the people. The first known missionary went into, it was in a Tangkhul village, my wife's ancestors, Rakmi's ancestors. It was a different tribe all the way back in 1841. And then the Pettigrews that she mentioned earlier, the missionary Pettigrews, Allison and William Pettigrew, came to her hometown in 1896. And the British gradually took administrative control over the area where the Naga people lived. My impression is they didn't really interfere too much. The Naga people basically went on with their lives, except for these missionaries coming in. And it's really an interesting story. It seems to me an improbable story about why the missionaries were so successful. I don't feel like I understand why they were so successful. Today, what I read is that 95% of all the Nagas are Christians of one sort or another. Most of them descended from the American Baptist tradition. It's interesting. I don't know why that worked out, but it did. Anyway,
and just to butt in, it mm-hmm. is very interesting, because everyone just assumes that if you go to India, it's going to be Hindu mm-hmm. or Muslim.
Right. Mainland India mostly is, the main body of India, the India we see in the news. And if you see an Indian movie, it would have been shot in what is mainland India. The Nagas first called for independence, for being independent of the mainland India and the British, all the way in 1929, but they were not granted independence. But after World War II, when the British were deciding to give up their empire, they could no longer sustain their empire after the impact of the war, India was going to gain its independence on August 15th in 1947. Well, the Naga, under the leadership of what's known as the Naga National Council, declared independence the day before that. But the newly independent government of India had no intention whatsoever of letting them actually be independent. So a guerrilla war ensued, which was basically crushed by the Indian Army going in there. The government of India, the Parliament of India, passed what's known as the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which gave a paramilitary group known as the Assam Rifles great latitude in the measures they used to suppress the independence movement in Northeast India. And then to try to accommodate to some extent the desire of Nagas to govern themselves, they did create a new state within Northeast India, which is called Nagaland, and that's where most Nagas live. Some also live in Manipur, which is the state Rakhmi is from, and then some in Assam, another state there, and there's another one, I don't know how to say it, though, Arunachal Pradesh.
Arunachal Pradesh.
But most Nagas lived in Nagaland, but that didn't really satisfy, because the Nagas really wanted to be independent, or at least the leaders of the independence movement. I don't have a sense of how much of a majority there was for independence, but fighting went on until what's called the Shillong Accord was signed in 1975, and that was signed between the government of India and this Naga National Council that I mentioned. And in that accord, the Naga National Council agreed to accept the Indian Constitution without objection and to give up their arms. Well, that started trouble within the Naga. That split the Naga into different factions, and another organization called the National Socialist Council of Nagaland rose up as a new independence movement and kept fighting, and then it split, and it split more than once, so now there's divisions and factionalism and infighting and sometimes killing between Naga groups. But it's really occupied territory. There's this body called the Assam Rifles, which is a paramilitary force rather than the regular Indian Army. And they literally do occupy Manipur, Nagaland. You know, Sharon, when we went into the mountains, we had to stop at a checkpoint in one of the villages on the way into the mountain. There's only one road into the mountains. And we had to register with the Assam Rifles. And there's an Assam Rifles base right there in her home, Rakhmi's hometown, Ukhral, right in the center. And you'll see troops every so often just marching through town, not really doing anything. And when I first saw that, I was like, well, what is the point here? What are they doing? Because they don't actually seem to be doing anything. And then I came to the realization that the point is just to make sure everybody knows we're still here. Mm-hmm. Don't get any ideas.
No. And wasn't Independence Day coming up, or Republic Day? We got out of there ahead of what was expected to be trouble. Did any trouble come on?
I didn't hear anything. Yeah.
Oh, good. Good.
There was no violence that we've heard of, but there sometimes is. Republic Day commemorates when the Indian government became a republic. There's also a separate Independence Day that's celebrated on August 15th for when India became independent of the British Empire. But back to the independence movement, then there was this group called the National Socialist Council of Nagaland that had been fighting for independence. They negotiated with the Indian government, and there was a ceasefire declared between the National Socialist Council of Nagaland and the Indian government in 1997, but it only applied to the state of Nagaland, where most Nagas, but not all of them, live. It didn't apply to the other states, and it didn't apply to Manipur, where Rakhmi's hometown is. So there's sort of this unofficial, uneasy, and far from perfect ceasefire that prevails, but I was reading in the papers while we were there, or was it shortly afterward online? I can't remember now, but that there was a possibility of the ceasefire being ended. So it's still a low-level state of conflict that could burst into greater conflict. And it gets even more complicated because we're not just talking about the government of India and the Naga. There are multiple other ethnic groups there, and at least some of them want independence too, but their independence desires conflict with the Naga independence desires. There's in Manipur state, there's a group called the Maitai, who are about 60% of the population. They want to be independent. They have the People's Liberation Army of Manipur. And there's another group called the Kuki, who live in the foothills of the mountains, and they want to be independent. And so you have all these conflicting. It's very complicated. I have no idea what could be done to resolve that situation. I have sympathy for any people who are living under occupation. And you can't say it's not an occupation if there are armed soldiers in your town that aren't your own soldiers, that are soldiers from somewhere else. But I don't know. And of course, Rakhmi grew up under the conditions of the occupation, and it's, I don't know what to say about it, but it was, I'd never experienced anything like that, having to stop at a military checkpoint in order to get someplace and see armed troops with automatic weapons right there. And
then when we left, we had to check out. And
yeah, we had to check out on the way out.
They had misplaced our records.
Right.
And we were kind of like, oh, dear, what's going to happen now?
Because we had a plane to catch. And you know, do they not let you out of the mountains if they can't find a record of you going into the mountains? I don't know.
Well, it was quite something going up the mountain. It took us 3 hours to travel up this mountain road, which was about like our single-lane road with two lanes of
about traffic. The width of a standard American highway lane.
Yes,
but with traffic going both directions.
Yeah, oh my gosh. The first time a bus rounded the corner in front of us, I couldn't figure out what all the buses were. I thought they were tour buses. Well, they buses bring all day long, they travel the roads for the village people to get into the town of
the city of Imphal.
Because
which is the capital of Manipur.
Yeah, that is where all the trade exchange happens. You know, like they will bring the goods from the rest of the India, which we don't produce there or which we don't manufacture there. And so people go down there and from all the hilly place to get those stuff and then to do a business, I mean, bring out those stuff. And then two business in their own village.
We should probably pause right here for a break, and we'll be back with John Fish Kerman and Rakhmi Shaiza and more about our trip to India.
Sure. Let me see. While growing up, I know that, you know, like the rest of the India or in Pakistan, that women or girls, I mean girls, suffer more than the tribal girls in Northeast India because we have a lot of independence, like going to school without being fear of like people stopping us or banding that they can't go to the school. So we have that independence to go to school, to learn, and have a freedom of expressions. But when like the decision making, women don't have a lot of freedom to make decisions for the families or for the community. Like you and John, you see in the church or in the even in our blessing ceremony that, you know, most of the men will come and make a decision for us, but without even asking what you want or what I want. So we grew up, I mean, in that kind of condition. One, we have that independent, like where we can learn, we can go places, but there is that when we come to the bigger decisions, then we lost that independence. We lost?
Yeah.
Yeah, we lost that independence again. Just for an example, like, you know, me, like in our family, that when we want to go to a university, we were six of us. And
six children in the family.
Yeah, six children in the family, and all of us, I mean, my sisters, all of us were very, like, interested in studying, good in studies, and we all want to go to good universities. But then when it comes, and since it's six of us that, you know, my parents did not have enough money to send all of us. So who goes there? My two brothers will go to the big universities and get their good educations there. And so those are something, and still, and there are a lot of women that faces that problem, that women will be the one who will stay back from or who will give up, who will sacrifice from getting what they want. And so a lot of the, a lot of them are getting what, how should I say it? Like fulfilling their dreams, and they got education, but there are more women that is not, we're not able to fulfill their dreams. And because we all believe that, you know, in education, and if we don't fulfill that education and our dream of getting an education, then somehow we feel like as if we want to, like there is nothing worth doing it. And so those are some of the situations that I grew up with and some of the situations that women face.
You know, of course, I was only there 12 days, so I want to be a little cautious about making too general pronouncements. But it certainly seemed to me that women are still second-class citizens there, and not just in the big decisions. When it comes to cooking meals and cleaning up after meals, the women did almost all the work. One of her sister's husbands was a cook as well. But mostly it was the women who did the work, and the men didn't contribute at all in that. And there's a story you told me. They didn't say it to me, but when we were having meals at least once, someone came up to you and asked why you weren't serving me.
Oh, yeah. We went to that Pangrai Peak.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was in Chiray Peak. And so we climbed that peak for 2 hours, and we came down, and I was really tired and hungry. This is like, we go up there just eating our breakfast, and we hiked the whole day, come down there at 4:30.
So we'd had no lunch.
No, we had no lunch yet. And so I was really hungry, and the lunch was ready then, right? And so I went and get my food and my plates, and then one of my friends who came along with us was really upset with me, and she said, why aren't you serving your husband? And I told her, John is a grown-up man, he can decide what he wants to get, and he said, that is an American culture, and you are here, you have to follow that, that you have to serve your husband. And I said, I don't think I can do that. And so anyway, that was just a example. And you also, you and Sharon saw how my sister-in-law, you know, like cooked all the time and then clean all those
very busy.
Yeah, dishes.
She hardly
and then
sat down.
Our men will just come and eat and just leave and do their, wherever they go, and go on there for business.
And there's no washing machines there, so we did the washing in big tubs. And people seem to be mostly very surprised that I did the laundry with Rockne, or when I would help to clean something. They seemed very surprised that I was doing women's work. And, you know, let's not get on our high horses here. Women have still not been allowed to have full and complete equality in this country either. And there are places where it is much worse than what I saw in Ukraine. But it is not full equality, that's to be sure. I wouldn't say I was surprised by that, but it was interesting. It was interesting to see the way it played out.
So are there legal protections for women and just a cultural subclass? Or a lot of times I think that's what's happening even here, is that legally women may have rights, but still culturally it's hard to fulfill the rights that we're supposed to be having.
I'm sure there is, and even in our own customs and traditional law, there is a protection for women. But, you know, it is just a very simple one. I'm not very sure about that.
Again, I was only there 12 days, but my impression is that the laws of the government of India aren't really much considered in the mountain towns and villages. That they have their own customs there. They have, each village has their own king and queen, or sometimes just a king or sometimes just a queen, I guess, and their own ways of doing things, and they don't really think much about the laws of the government of India. I think the government of India has protections in the law for women, but we've certainly heard the news stories where women are treated sometimes quite horrifically in other parts of India. And Rakmi has told me stories about when she has visited cities in mainland India and the way women are, I don't want to characterize it, but the way the women are treated by men, strange men on the street. And do you want to talk about that, too?
Sure.
Well, Dimpy took me out shopping
one
day.
You should say who Dimpy is.
Dimpy is Rakmi's sister-in-law. Let me think, how does this go? No, what? Dimpy is a Sim, Rakmi's sister's sister-in-law.
Yes.
And she's not a Naga. She's from a different ethnic group.
She is
Anglo-Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And a beautiful, beautiful person, as was her husband, Richard. Oh, my God. I can't wait to see pictures of Richard.
Apparently the ladies think Richard's quite a hunk.
He's a good person.
He is a very nice person. And Dimpy took me out shopping one day, and a man grabbed her, and she's like six months
you didn't
pregnant.
Tell me that, Sean.
Oh, yeah. He grabbed her and pinched her behind. And
Some
strange man just did that, and she kind of cursed at him and turned around and shook her fist at him. But that would be kind of a customary thing you have to deal with.
Yeah.
And this is in a major Indian city. What would be a progressive city in South India? Of course, it wasn't so long ago those sorts of things happened in the United States, and probably some places still do. Again, we are talking about challenges and some of the problems they face, particularly in Northeast India, but in India as well. But I by no means want this to be a, oh, those poor people over there sort of story. I wanted to talk about one of the really beautiful things that I saw in Ukhrul, is how close their families and the community still is. I mean, they're facing a lot of struggles because the population of Ukhrul is growing quite dramatically, in large part because of people moving in from other villages, because it's sort of the big town of the Ukhrul district, which includes other villages. But still, I mean, the families live so close together. It reminded me a lot of what life was like when I was a little kid living in Edwardsville, Illinois, small town in Illinois. My grandparents all lived close by. Aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews lived close by, as well as more distant relations. And, you know, I mentioned uncles and nieces and nephews. That's another thing about the Tangkul and the Naga culture, is their concept of who is an uncle and who is an aunt and who is a niece and who is a nephew and a cousin and all of this is much, much broader than ours here in the United States. You want to say something about that, Rakmi?
Sure. Like, when all the Shaisas, even though we are not close cousins, then everyone becomes like our auntie and uncle. And like, even the neighbors, you know, all the neighbors, our neighbors knows what we are doing, and everybody knows what one is doing. And so, yeah, that is one of the most beautiful things that I have experienced in life, and that I am missing that since I am here. Mm-hmm. So, because I don't know, you know, we don't know our neighbors, and we can hardly get together, I mean, with our families. Like, one of the things that I really miss in Ukhrul is, in my hometown, is that that I can go visit anyone without emailing them or calling them on the phone and make an appointment, but just, you know, come, like, you know, you and I did when we were there, like, just drop in and say mm-hmm. hi, and everybody will offer us a tea.
The doors were so open, people were so hospitable, we'd show up without giving any notice that we were coming, and we were treated like family. And in a lot of, not all the people we visited, a lot of them were family, although somewhat more distant family than the folks we stayed with, but it was so beautiful.
Yeah, even if we visit friends, they will treat you like that, even if you are not a family member.
I was sad to see that it seems to be beginning to break down in the same way that it has broken down for the most part here in the United States, and it's breaking down for the same reasons. The young people, a lot of them, are moving away to get jobs because it's tough to get a job that pays anything in Ukraine. There aren't a lot of economic opportunities, so a lot of the young Naga women and Naga men have gone off to work in Indian cities in mainland India. You've said that there are Naga women who are working like on cruise lines and things like that.
Yes, a lot of them.
So the families are becoming more distant. The young people are becoming more distant from their family members there, which is understandable, but I still worry for what the consequences of that are going to be.
Yeah, I think there was a mass migration 2 years ago from the age of 18 to 25, like migrating to, like you say, in a city like Mumbai, Bangalore, Calcutta, to find jobs. And, you know, like I said, I haven't done any academic research on these, but the stories that I heard, that a lot of these young women or young men that goes to Bangalore don't have the skills to work in a city and to work for good jobs. They are working like in a shops as a salesman or saleswomen, and they are facing a lot of like harsh treatments from the owner, sometimes sexual
harassment.
Oh, yes, that's what I was looking for. And then even, you know, emotional harassment. And so a lot of the young people are facing that. And I forgot to mention that, you know, like the women's condition back home currently, present that when I went back in 2010, I saw a lot of women started to drink alcohol, and it was just very discouraged to see that. And when we go this time, also the same thing. There were more women that is started to use alcohol, and so I met with some of the women and asked them, like, you know, why is this happening, and they feel like as if they are facing a lot of, you know, domestic situation, like that they are not fulfilled in their life. And so instead of, like, finding some, like you say, there is not a lot of jobs or any, you know, not a lot of creative things that is happening there. And so they got depressed and frustrated, and in order to numb their feelings, they started to drink this. And so a lot of them are, and once, you know, like in our society, women, if they do these things, then it is more the, how should I say, when people perceptions is like, oh, they are women and they are drinking, so it is more shameful for women to drink. And so they are not drinking because they want to, but they are frustrated. And so the other problem is that once they drink, then I'm sure there is a domestic abuse issue at home, that, you know, the husband is beating them. And once they do that, then there is no place. Sharon, you and I talk about this, and that there is no counseling place to go, or no support system.
No shelter for victims of domestic violence.
No, and
Rakmi has a dream, and she's been working on this dream. I believe you've got a group of women in Ukraine that are supporting you. She wants to start a women's center and go back and do some training for women so that the women there will be trained to help one another. And also talking that in their culture, if you, for example, if your husband is an alcoholic, it would be shameful for you to talk to anyone about that.
Exactly.
And so therefore they do have Al-Anon and AA, or AA at least, but to go to those meetings for a woman would be a shameful thing because it's not in their culture to do that.
I actually, in Ukraine, I don't think there is anything like AA. You would have to go, there are rehab centers in the capital city of the state, Imphal,
Which is a 3-hour ride.
They're a 3-hour ride, and they are beyond the beyond affordability for most people.
Speaking of affordability, I'd like to share that four children, your sister and your brother and sister-in-law's four children, can go to a private school for a year for $156. That's the total cost for four children in a private school. And the private schools are better because the teachers usually show up, I understand.
Yes.
And in the
yes,
public
yes.
school, the teachers may not just show up. They're paid by the government, and the government's going to issue their paycheck, and they may or may not come to teach. And in fact, I think when we drove to where you went to college as a youngster, a young woman there, and we drove and we drove and we drove, it seemed for a long time, and then you said to us, well, I used to walk here every day from my home.
It was like a 45-minute walk.
She says 45 minutes, and I'm like, how in the heck? I mean,
she was young.
She was young, yeah.
In
yeah.
good shape. And she had grown up walking all over
yeah.
the place, so she was in good shape
yeah.
to walk all over the place. You know, having done Eco Radio KC and being an advocate for clean air, clean water, climate-safe energy and all that, I wanted to just quickly say that this whole influx of packaged food and packaged body care products and packaged everything that's just happened since RockMe moved away in 2000 has presented this whole other problem of trash that they never, non-biodegradable trash that they have never had to deal with in the entire history of their people in any significant amount. And so they have no good way of dealing with trash. You rarely see a trash can. Instead, you see trash everywhere. Literally, I was astounded in these beautiful, beautiful mountains that there is trash literally everywhere. Even up the mountain peaks that we climbed, all the way up the trails, there's trash along the ways of the sides of the trails. Some trash does get collected, but the only way they have to deal with it is to burn it, which is terrible too, because that, you know, burn plastics and inks on paper and things, that puts toxic chemicals into the air.
And when I was young, I think people in this country were more likely to throw trash
mm-hmm.
out of their cars, and people had to be trained to do that. And RockMe preached a sermon at her church the last Sunday we were there, and I could tell she was preaching in her native language, but I could tell because sometimes she would say Los Angeles,
right.
or she would say, and I knew because I'd listened to RockMe, so I had a pretty good idea of what she was telling the people. Tell a little bit about what your sermon was to your native
sure.
village.
You know, like in church, sometimes it's hard for them to talk about the ecological problem because they think that church is, you know, only to preach about salvation, about sin, and about Jesus Christ. So one of the things that I challenged my community when I was preaching was that, you know, as a Christian, we need to deeply care for this. And so I bring out about all these deforestation that is happening there and the trash that is happening there. And I ask them the concept of, you know, like, because everybody thinks that it is a Western style to use a disposable now because, you know, it's something standard. It's like viewing as a high standard. And say, I ask them, where are you going to throw this away and where is away? Like John said, and away is our future generation away. And if we don't start doing this right now, then the consequences is going to be so huge because we don't have a wealth resources like the rest of the world does. Ours, like I said, more than 90% of us depends on where the nature's give us. So once we spoil the river, once we spoil the land, then there will be a lot of famine, difficulties, and even social chaos.
Yeah. And one thing I want to make sure I mention before the show's over that I did also put links on the Every Woman Facebook pages too, albeit they're the Wikipedia entries, so you always got to be a little careful when reading a Wikipedia entry. But the Wikipedia entries for both the Naga ethnic group and Rockme's tribe, the Tonkul tribe, if folks are interested in reading those.
And I just want to say this to Sharon before the time that, you know, with all this, we talk about all this that is sad things happening there, but both of you have seen it, that it's a very beautiful place.
It is, absolutely,
that,
tremendously.
You know, filled with mountains and good people, but I think they need us to educate them in so many ways, and they also...
And we need to learn from them.
Yes, and encourage, we also need to encourage them that the new vision has to come out from their own community, not from relying on other people.
Yeah, and Americans should not look down on other people for their trash or their poor air quality. No nation has done more damage to the living community of the world than Americans have.
That's for sure. We haven't even touched on many, many things.
Well, maybe we could continue another day. Maybe we haven't talked much about Bangalore.
the autos.
I know.
My very favorite part, riding those three-wheelers. It was like a carnival ride every time. I would get so excited. Thank you, Rock Me,
yes.
Shiza, and John Fishkerman.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you, Amy, for
letting me go to India and meet your family. It was a great honor.
Thank you.
Oh, and by the way, stay tuned for Urban Connections with Donna Wolf, and following that will be Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson.